All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. My name is Jay Caruso. Ben Howe is a little under the weather this week, unfortunately, so he is not going to be here. So, the news gal, Andrea Ruth, is going to be filling in for him.
Really?
How are you?
I'm great.
Just really? That's it? You sound excited. It's like, wow. I get a chance to fill in. Our guest is going to be Jay Cost from formerly the Weekly Standard. He's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's going to be here in a little bit, and then we'll bring him in. Also, as we say always, the top of the show, if you like the show, go to our website, www.thefifthestate.us, and you can sign up there, kind of get the shows into your podcast app. And the other thing that we wanted to talk about, and this is pretty important for us, one of the things that's been great, going back to the original duo of this podcast back in 2016, it's been 3 years now, Neil Dewing and I started this. We wanted to have a podcast that, was not so much different, I should say, but different from what we had previously done. We kind of just did this podcast where it was like we'd pick five or six news items and then four of us would kind of rattle on about it and then end. And this one, the one we started the Fifth Estate to have a little bit more in-depth conversation and kind of talk about things. And, the thing that's so amazing is that we took, an entire year off. I mean, I said we were putting the show on hiatus and figured maybe it'd be 5 or 6 months. It turned into a year. There's a whole bunch of life changes and things of that nature that took place that kind of pushed it forward. But then I brought it back. Ben agreed to be a co-host. We brought Andrea in to kind of do the news and also fill in doing some stuff. And the response has been terrific. We a lot of our subscribers, the people that are out there listening every week, we love it. It's great. You guys are the backbone of this. And so one of the things that we wanted to do, and if you're listening now, you may have been one of the people that took a survey that we did. We started talking about premium content. Like, would you like to hear some content that may not be available during the regular part of the show? And, ask, of course, if we're talking premium content, it's something you have to pay for. And rather than having to listen to ads, we did some ads here on the Fifth Estate, and who knows, we may have to do them again at some point. I don't know. Right now, we're not. We're just, it's kind of an ad-free experience. There's no stopping in the middle to sit there and talk about toothbrushes or suitcases or anything like that. But there are costs associated with doing the podcast, and so they're not substantial, but they are there. And so Slate came up with a way. They have a system called Supporting Cast. And essentially what that does is it allows us to offer premium content to our listeners. Now, the best part about it, and this is the thing that intrigued me more than anything else, was that unlike, say, something like Patreon, where you get a notification that the content is available, you have to go to the Patreon website and download, kind of listen to an MP3 of the additional content. Supporting Cast allows you to, if you use Apple Podcasts, if you use Google Podcasts, if you use Overcast, you use other things, it allows you to get that premium content right within that app. Okay. So we have done that. We have kind of rolled this out. We talked, we asked people if they would be willing to pay, how much, what kind of range would be willing to pay, what kind of content that they wanted to see under premium content. And so we've done that. And so if you go to, I just have to make sure the URL here, I don't want to sit there and get this wrong. All right, so if you go to Fifth, and this is FIFTHESTATE, so fifthestate.supportingcast.fm, it's Frank Mary, so like FM radio. So fifthestate.supportingcast.fm, and we'll put the link in the show notes and everything like that so you can see it. You go there, there's not a whole bunch of things to fill out. You don't have to register. You don't have to fill in a whole bunch of forms. You don't have to do a whole bunch of stuff. You're not going to get emails all over the place. You click on join and you put in your name and you put in your credit card information and you'll pay this small nominal fee once a month. And, it's not a lot. It's $3.99 a month. So, you know, remember Sally Struthers used to do those Feed the Children things where she would talk about, you know, for the price of less than a cup of coffee, you can contribute to this. What we're doing is for an entire month, we're saying for the price of, what is it, Andrea? Less than
Grande vanilla soy latte.
There you go. Grande vanilla soy latte for less than what it costs for one of those at Starbucks for an entire month. You can do that. We are offering up, you know, a program that is, you know, less than, you know, probably, you know, 1% of GDP of third world nations. You know, so this is not a lot. You know, you could buy a couple of packs of gum with what you'd have to spend here. But really, it's not a lot. It is, we are going to, like, you know, the first thing we can say right now, we're going to do the first one. We're going to have a discussion after the show with Jay Cost. He's going to continue to kind of talk with some subjects for us, and we may do that. You'll have some, you know, may hear Andrea, me, and Ben just kind of having casual conversation about certain things, maybe talk about something other than politics, you know, maybe, what are our favorite TV shows, things like that that we know people like and they enjoy, and just brings an added benefit. So
now, is subscribing to a podcast kind of like avocado toast, where if I do it, then I won't be able to buy a house?
No, not at all. You'll be able to buy your home, and you'll be able to have as much avocado toast as you want, because, you know, this really just doesn't, you know, it's $3.99 a month. It's less than a dollar a week. We're going to do our best to kind of bring, we're not, you know, it's not going to be a situation where we're just going to go ahead and say, yeah, well, we talked about, you know, the garbage strike in New York City for 10 minutes after the show is over, even though none of us live in New York. You know, it is going to be something that we want to bring some value to. So, because, you know, we appreciate it. All you people who've been there, who've been listening for the short term, who've been listening for the last year or so, or who've been listening right from the beginning. Our first show is with Charles Cook of National Review. So if you go back that far, you can remember that's who we talked to. And
I will say that, yeah, because we already were recording this after we recorded the interview with Jay Cost and the premium content, there's some pretty juicy stuff in the premium content this week.
Yeah, it's funny, we're reverse engineering this how we're recording it. So we've already spoken with Jay, and yeah, there we talked about some stuff. I could say we discussed a little bit about the 2020 election and particularly the Democratic Party. But then we went into some other stuff that was kind of unplanned, which is the best part about having some of that premium content. I got to tell you, there's some stuff there that Jay said that is pretty interesting about the Republican side and conservatives. So you'll definitely want to check that out. So that's kind of what we're hoping to bring to that. So once again, fifthestate.supportingcast.fm. You know, you put in your name, put in your credit card, $3.99 a month. You can cancel at any time if you don't like it. It's not something you're going to get locked into, and it's very easy to go and cancel the payment. You don't have to sit there and, like, you know, jump through hoops in order to do it. So give it a try, and if you like it, hey, let other people know. Send us feedback. You know us on Twitter. You've got email addresses. Please let us know what you think. If you hate it, if you love it, if there's something you want to see. We're doing it for you guys, so that's part of the, you know, that's part of the deal. So anyway,
is this the longest explanation you'll ever go into this?
Hey, you know, we're
it's
launching
TLDR
it.
TLDR at this point.
No, we're launching it. You're not reading; they're listening. And so, okay, for a one hour podcast, the audience will appreciate listening to for about 4 or 5 minutes.
I just know that there's a lot of people offering that have skipped ahead 30 seconds.
I guarantee,
like,
they haven't. I guarantee they haven't. I guarantee it.
All right.
Well, anyway,
we'll find out.
Moving along. Okay. So let's talk about big news of the day today was William Barr, who was testifying in front of, I think he was testifying in front of the Senate, and they were excuse me. Ooh, that's not part of the thing. Anyway. So, yeah, you get that. That's free.
Jay, you have to take that.
No, I'm not. So they were sitting there talking about the Mueller report and what was going to be in it and what was going to happen. Now, at one point, Barr said he believes that spying did occur on the Trump campaign. Now, this, of course, lit up Twitter like you wouldn't believe, because the usual suspects the Trumpist part of the GOP who have been going around calling the Russian collusion investigation a hoax and saying it's a witch hunt and all this other stuff, basically said, you see, we were right. Obama's Justice Department did spy on the Trump campaign. We knew it. And, you know, now it's all he did was say that. Now, if you, and once again, it's like one of these things where I think it was, wasn't Gabe Maller tweeted today something about like wait an hour before saying something, you know, and sure enough, further on during Barr's testimony, he said, I'm not suggesting those rules were violated, but I think it's important to look at that. And I'm not just talking about the FBI necessarily, but intelligence agencies more broadly. I'm not saying that improper surveillance occurred. I'm saying that I am concerned about it and looking into it. That's all. So essentially what Barr said was, yeah, there might have been spying. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I'm going to take a look at it. Okay, so nope, nothing was confirmed here. And he said, I just want to satisfy myself that there were no abuse of law enforcement or intelligence powers. Now, that's a perfectly reasonable thing for him to say. It's a perfectly reasonable thing for him to do, because I think that there should be. No, they should look into it, because there's been some stuff. I mean, you know, you could sit there. Some people going so far as to call it a coup. I don't think it's a coup. I hate that word. But there were some FBI players that weren't acting in the interest of their job. They were acting in the interest of politics, and law enforcement officials shouldn't do that, especially at the highest levels of government. Do you agree, Andrea? I mean, it seems to be fair that he can look into it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that once you get, you know, if you have these instances where we do know that the Trump Tower, the offices, I think of what Paul Manafort when he was there, were wiretapped for, they were, you know, because they were looking into Russian collusion.
Right.
And because
Paul Manafort, even the Russian. Yeah, they were looking into his relationship with Russians.
Exactly. So it was. So it wasn't Trump, but it was the Tower. And
right.
That someone that close to a presidential candidate was. Basically spied on, which was, you know, justified at the time, as we now know.
Let me just caution there. He wasn't spied on. He was being investigated. So
right,
there's
okay,
a difference. There was a criminal investigation with Manafort.
Right,
yeah.
So you'll forgive me. but that someone that close to a presidential candidate, that did happen, is something that if it's just let fly this time, that next time it won't be okay, well, we got away with it this time. You know, it's how far, you know, you give an inch, they'll take a mile type of idea. Well, it's absolutely justified that Bill Barr would, or William Barr would, go and look into this so that future, you know, law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies don't then decide, okay, well, maybe we can do this time.
Right. You know? Yeah. I mean, there shouldn't be a political agenda amongst our intelligence and law enforcement agencies. And I think everybody will agree on that. You know, but at the same time, for people to resurrect Trump's old tweet about his phones being tapped and saying, you see, you media morons were telling you this was a lie and it turns out that it's true. That's just stupid. It's like this one thing, you sit there and you get a little nugget of news and suddenly you're blowing up Twitter and you're blowing up social media and you're blowing everything up saying, we told you, we told you, we told you. And then an hour later, Bill Barr says, whoa, 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 slow down a second. I'm not saying anything necessarily happened. I just want to make sure it didn't. So there isn't this whole idea that, yes, it's confirmed that the Trump campaign was spied upon by the Obama administration. We don't know that. We do know there's certain aspects out there in the public, Peter Strzok and all those who acted a little bit improperly, even Andrew McCabe. You know, there were some politics there, and that's not good. But that's a whole different, you know, a big leap from that to there. Yes, they were spying on the Trump campaign. I think everybody, it's like, take a fucking breath just for once. Sit back. Let the news play out. You know, this is it's just ridiculous. Like everything, every tiny little thing. We talked about this last week. Something happens and everybody's just ready to just like jump up. And I was like, when Barr kind of like all of a sudden pulled back on his statements a little bit, I tweeted that a whole bunch of blog posts just went into like, you know.
Oh, you know, that's true. You know that a lot of blog posts got moved to the trash file.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was just like all of a sudden it was like, oh, damn, you know, they didn't actually do it, you know. So, you know, so that's something that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, just take it easy. You know, it's kind of crazy that people just automatically, like, you know, jump to conclusions on this kind of thing. So, all right. So the other news,
Doing news today.
Well, we're both doing news, and I'm talking about the big news, and then you got your news.
No, I don't have any news.
Oh, well, there you go. So then we'll just sit there and go ahead and talk about this other issue that happened over the weekend.
Okay.
So Kirstjen Nielsen, Secretary of Homeland Security,
this is boring news, though.
It is kind of boring. But there's...
I actually do have a news story.
Okay. But she did resign. She really didn't resign. She was kind of pushed out. She was forced out. And then Trump is kind of like firing some other people within you know, that infrastructure. And of course, you know, now, of course, this has people on the left freaking out. Now, what kills me is, like, the people that were there, you were sitting there. It's like everybody's like, I just forgot her last name.
Gillibrand.
No, not Gillibrand.
Oh, Kirstjen Nielsen.
Kirstjen Nielsen will always be remembered as the person who separated families at the border. You know, and then you have people referring to ICE as a terrorist organization and doing all these different horrible different things. And then Trump starts firing people in these organizations and people are freaking out because he's firing people. What do you want? You know, you can't have it the way you want it all the time, okay? So if you don't like Kirstjen Nielsen, if you don't like ICE, if you don't like the Border Patrol, don't sit there and get all crazy about them when Trump goes and fires people because he doesn't like the job that they're doing.
Well, now, it goes all the way back to Comey. Hillary Clinton would have been completely justified firing Comey herself if she had become president. But because Trump fired Comey... And the way that he did it and when he did it, you know, that created a huge scandal. And now Comey, you know, runs around the country tweeting weird esoteric photos, you know.
I mean, yeah. Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I wrote about this and I said, you know, Trump's management is just absurd because he doesn't understand how government works. It's like, this is not like firing an advertising or marketing person and just bringing somebody new in.
Right.
It doesn't work that way. And so
no,
now
it
you
does
have
matter.
Yeah, you have holes in a lot of agencies. He still doesn't have a Secretary of Defense, you know, and he doesn't even have an official chief of staff. I mean, Mick Mulvaney is quote unquote the acting, which is kind of ridiculous because chief of staff doesn't require Senate confirmation.
Since there's not a Secretary of Defense right now, I would petition for it to be renamed the Department of War again.
Let's go back to war. But there's several other agencies that don't have, you know, that are kind of like in limbo, and you know his turnover rate at, you know, it at the cabinet level and the White House, it's absurd. He goes through people. Like, you know, like again, like it's turnover at like a retail store where, you know, you got teenagers working for you that decide to go work somewhere else.
Ben Carson's still chugging away over at HUD.
Oh, yeah. He's over there. And, you know, there are some. I mean, if you look, I mean, most of his cabinet is still there. But there's been a lot more vacancies in the first 2 years in Trump's White House than there was like in the previous three administrations combined. I mean, that's and you're talking about three, you know, two term administrations that had less turnover in the first couple of years combined than Trump has had. And it's just kind of ridiculous. And it goes to the fact that he thinks that if something is going wrong, the buck doesn't stop with him. So like the fact that there were more and more immigrants coming across the border and they were catching more, he blamed Kirstjen Nielsen because she wasn't doing what he wanted her to do. And she said, the reason she said no is because she said, I'm constrained by the law, sir. I can't do what you're asking me to do. And when they go and do some of the things that he wants, the courts step in and say, no, you can't do that. And so they're just like, see, we told you. And then he's like, well, I'm firing you. I want someone tougher.
Well, I mean, I think the example, though, is the previous administration, though, correct? I mean, when you had Barack Obama say that he could not issue Dreamers green cards, and then his legal, you know, his attorney general and Justice Department, you know, decided to go ahead and print them up and give them out anyway, and, you know, barring a the Supreme Court getting involved or the judiciary getting involved. I mean, that's the example, right? You go ahead and do things even though you know that they're illegal.
Right, but this is a situation where he made the decision. I don't know if he had it. Obama was saying, I can't do it. Were other people saying to him, was that because other people were telling him? My guess is not. That was all a facade. This is Trump, I think, saying, let's do it. And people are saying, we can't.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's right.
It's kind of like there is that dynamic. But at the same time, I think, this is where Trump has a problem. It's like, it's not the people, it's not necessarily the people you have working for you. It's your ideas, your inability to comprehend that government is not like a family business that you run, and things move slowly and they move methodically and they do so because of bureaucracy, but they also do so for a reason. I mean, let's face it, the whole thing with the military is the hurry up and wait. There's that. They want things done fast, but you can't do that. And it can be frustrating for someone like Trump who's, basically because he worked in a family business, he said, fire that guy and bring this guy in. Okay, done. You can do it in the same day. Here, it doesn't work like that in government. And he still doesn't seem to grasp that. And he doesn't care to grasp that because he's never decided to actually sit down and take the time to learn, the history of the presidency.
He essentially wants, Stephen Miller to be the, fill Kirstjen Nielsen's place, but he can't get confirmed by the Senate, and Trump feels hamstringed by that. He has to choose someone that can be confirmed.
Right, exactly. There's no way Stephen Miller gets through a Senate thing. Okay, so what news stories you got?
Oh, nothing. I was kind of joking. I mean, but this is a kind of like it's funny but also serious. Is that Kim Kardashian West, who has worked with the Trump administration to get Alice Johnson out of prison and do a lot for criminal justice reform? She is studying for the bar exam and plans to take it at the California bar in 2022. Her dad was a famed Robert Kardashian, was on the defense team for OJ. So.
Yeah, and of course, I think it was Carol Roth who kind of lambasted. When that was announced, there was all kinds of like mockery.
Yeah, she brought it up in an interview with like Vanity Fair or something like that.
Yeah, and so like if you don't follow Carol J S Roth on Twitter, you should. She's been on the Right Side podcast that Andrea co-hosts with Kim Ross, really good. But she kind of lambasted people who were like, going after. I can't remember what she said. I'm trying to find her tweet.
Carol Roth hasn't been on the podcast. It was Carol Markowitz, and I messed her name up on the podcast, which I then deleted. So now you just messed it up too.
I thought you had Carol Roth on there one time.
No, you did. You had Carol Roth on the Fifth Estate once. Anyway, did you find Carol Roth's tweet?
No, I didn't. You screwed me up here.
Okay, well, I will find it because I have it right here. And you can, because I have people here. I have Twitter.
Okay, no, I found it.
I found it. California bar is.
I found it. She said, why are people crapping on this? In this country, you have the opportunity for reinvention and lifelong learning. That is tremendous. How about instead of spending your time dragging people down who are creating, you take and create your own stuff? Now, the thing with Kim Kardashian in California, she is not going to law school. She's going to intern or something at some kind of...
And she's got private tutors, which she has the money for.
Right. And so, and just so you know, that in California, and I learned this today through Jeff Blair, that you don't have to have been a graduate of law school to sit for the bar exam. So there's been this kind of thing where like, oh, I heard California has the toughest bar exam. And Jeff said, no, the fact that anyone can really take the bar exam if they want to has kind of like upped the failure rate. Because it probably is harder for people who haven't gone to law school to pass a bar exam in California.
You know who did go to law school but couldn't pass the bar, had to give up after the third time he failed, was former LA mayor Tony Villaraigosa. He just gave up after the third time.
That's it's funny, it's like you you see people a lot of times that sit there and say, yeah, you know, I didn't, I just decided not to go ahead and take the bar exam anymore. I failed it like four or five times to figure, okay, that's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, hey, if she manages to do it, more power to her, you know, and it's true. I kind of agree with Carol, you know, Kim Kardashian largely been, you know, kind of mocked as, you know, like her and Paris Hilton, those types of famous for being famous, you know, that they born into wealth, didn't really do anything. You know, I mean, you know, she married Kanye West, who's loaded. She's loaded. I mean, but, you know, hey,
West is not that loaded. He was he was pretty hard up for money a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but I think he sold a few more albums and that was fixed. But, you know, point being is that, you know, let me just put it there. They're not struggling. Okay.
No,
they're not living paycheck to paycheck.
And Kim's younger sister is the youngest billionaire, self-made billionaire.
Right. Which, of course, people were like, oh, self-made. Blah, blah, blah. She did this and she blah, blah. You know, it's like, just who cares? You know, if she's a billionaire, she's a billionaire. And at least she's doing it, you know, from everything that we've seen, she's not like Elizabeth Holmes, like ripping people off to promote something that doesn't work. Like, you know, so just, it is kind of ridiculous. I think people should, you know, do some stuff instead of being professional critics. But that's kind of like what it is on social media.
Yeah, and I'm one of those people that I don't think you should have to go to law school to take the bar exam. I think that that's a, you know, a certain type of, I mean, I think it helps, but I think it's a certain barrier to entry that, you know, you can study the law and not, you know, technically have to go pay, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars to do it. All that stuff is readily accessible, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, if you can sit there and you don't have to like go to law school and spend the money, you know, because I mean, you're talking about going, getting a college degree and then going ahead and doing, you know, getting a, you know, it's like then going, spending 3 years of law school. That's a lot of damn money.
Yeah, no, I don't ascribe that same thing to, say, you know, engineering degrees or, you know, neurosurgery. You go to college for that kind of thing. But this, you know, you're the law, studying the law, you're ostensibly not killing people.
Yeah, no. In fact, I think I may have talked about this before somewhere else. Jason Fried, who is the CEO of a company called, well, now they're just called Basecamp. They used to be 37 Signals. He wrote a famous book called Rework, because they kind of like went about hiring people in a different way. It's like he didn't put too much emphasis on college degrees. You know, their application process is very unique. And, you know, and he was one of the first ones to sit there and say, you know, I don't think a college degree is all that. He said, I'm not disparaging them. He goes, I'm glad that my doctor has one. He says, but I don't think that they're absolutely necessary to certain things. If the person can do the work that you want them to do and do it well, why should you care what kind of, you know, piece of paper they have from 10 years ago that says they graduated from a school? So it's kind of one of those things. So, hey, you know, good luck to Mrs. West. And, I'm hoping that she passes that thing. That'd be pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, she wouldn't be the first lawyer in her family. So
no, she won't be the first lawyer. And, you know, if she does it, she'd be unlike, you know, like people like Felicity Huffman and the others who have like bribed college officials to get their kids into college. She'd do it on her own. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay. So Jay Koss is here. Well, actually, we kind of blew up the fact that Jay Koss was already here. So
sorry, I wanted to sell premium content. Thought that's what we were doing.
Like,
here.
We can't make it flow like, okay, Jay, we're gonna bring Jay in now. Actually, what we're gonna do is we're gonna skip ahead to the point where Jay joins the conversation, and we're gonna do that right now. So this week, last week, Ben and Andrea and I got into a pretty good discussion about parties and political power and the power that they have. And so I, you know, it's funny because some of it I was referring to an article that Jay Kost wrote for the Washington Examiner magazine called American Hangover, and thought it would be great to have Jay Kost come in and talk. And so he's our guest this week. Jay Kost is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. You probably read him at the Weekly Standard, at National Review, and now Washington Examiner. So, Jay, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It's great to be here.
All right, so let's get into this a little bit here. We had this discussion, and it was interesting because I had read your article. Your article came out several weeks ago, and then during my commute to the swamp from Virginia, I was listening to the Remnant podcast, and Jonah Goldberg and David French had made reference to the fact that parties just don't have as much power as they used to. And we talk about power, talking about the power to be able to pick candidates, and you know, so that's been left to quote unquote the people. And you wrote this fascinating piece because a lot of people would think, why on earth would we want to give parties more power? But you made a compelling case for the fact that, you know, the reason that they don't have much power is the reason why people are just kind of like, you know, so exhausted with politics. And if you can, at first, before we get into the details, just kind of give a 50,000 foot view of what you're talking about with respect to that.
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me on. I love any chance to talk about parties, especially. It's actually been sort of this research project that I've been working out at AEI. And when Seth Mandel, the editor of the Washington Examiner, pitched this idea to me, I was like, oh, this is perfect. This is right in my wheelhouse, right? So I've been looking at the historical origins of parties. And like the idea being like, okay, why do we have parties? I mean, parties exist in every democracy, right? What functions do they serve? And one of the old observations in political science literature in the middle of the 20th century was the parties, one of the things that parties do for voters is to regulate the choices that they can make, right? And you'd think, oh, well, you know, voters are, you know, we're sovereign. We should be able to make any choices we want. But when you think about it, this is not my observation. This is from a political scientist named E.E. Schatzschneider, said, you know, the people are sovereign, but they only have two words. The people are only able to say two words. They're able to say yes, and they're able to say no. So it really matters what questions we ask the people, right? So what we need, or at least the idea being behind political parties, is that political parties should be groups of, I don't want to say elites, but maybe sort of in a more classic Greek kind of sense of not like moneyed elites, but political people who care deeply about the public interest and who have taken it as a calling of themselves to be elite, sort of like a natural aristocracy is what maybe Hamilton would call it. But people who are really interested in the public welfare, organize through political parties and use the parties to present questions to the voters, right? So that you're, so, and ultimately in a good party system, you're not just voting for a candidate, you know, I like Bob over Bill, but you're voting for the platform that Bob promises to work with other like-minded people to implement in government. So this is how parties are the way by which your choice between candidate A and candidate B can, at least in theory, become a choice between platform A and platform B. That's the, from 50,000 feet, that's the value of political parties for the public at large. They frame elections in a way to transform individual candidate preferences that we have into policy preferences that the entire country can make.
Great. So, all right. So that's a great overview. So let's kind of get into the more of the details and some of why you say, you know, there are certain things that have happened that have kind of like pulled that kind of like, maybe I'm loath to use the word power. I don't know if that's the right word. But maybe influence or something that, you know, kind of keeps candidates kind of grounded. You know, I would think if you're looking at it from a Democratic perspective, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one that, you know, doesn't seem to be all that affected by Nancy Pelosi. And even though Nancy Pelosi publicly will sit there and say, you know, maybe you need to like be quiet a little bit. She's just out there she's not full steam ahead. Right. And you know, is that kind of like what you're talking about in that sense? Because they're really because of money and the way it's dispersed and how they have to raise it that has changed. Is that right?
A lot of it has to do with money. A lot of it also has to do with changes in the media landscape. So, and this gets back to, I mean, things that have been a lot of these are trends that have been working their way through for a while, but they seem to have accelerated recently, or at least maybe they've become more noticeable. I'm not sure. But so Ocasio-Cortez is an excellent example of how it is very difficult now for the parties to control their partisans. And the way that she's able to do this primarily, predominantly, is through social media, right? If you imagine a congressman, an upstart congressman in, say, 1919, as opposed to 2019, right? They can be like, oh, I'm going to break all the rules and I'm going to do whatever I want. It's like, well, why are you even in Congress? There's no opportunities for you to be a gadfly in Congress in 1919, right? There's no social media. There's no MSNBC. There's no Instagram. There's no Twitter, right? There's no videos, right? You know, you're just, you go to Washington, D.C., and there you are. You're going to play the game. Right. And so that's one of the challenges that parties have now, where like politics now is conferred upon some people, certain types of people, this instant celebrity status. So that creates sort of two problems. The first one is the parties don't really have any handholds on how to keep these people in line. Right. Like Pelosi can't punish her for misbehaving. Right. Because, and one of the reasons why is that Ocasio-Cortez now has her own independent power base, at least with liberal donors. But the other problem that she has is, you know, somebody like Ocasio-Cortez is not interested in coming to Washington and working away, you know, like, you know, the typical member of Congress from a Democratic district like hers, right? Brooklyn, right? Queens, she knows that as long as she wants to run, she will always be reelected. So the typical strategy for a member of Congress like that is similar to what her predecessor, Joe Crowley, did, which is I'm just going to get into leadership, or I'm going to get into the committee system. I'm going to pay my dues and I'm going to work the inside game to be influential. And in that scenario, Pelosi would have leverage over that person, right? If you want to rise through the ranks in Congress, you got to work through us, right? But Ocasio-Cortez has no interest in that, right? I mean, she doesn't care. You know, it's very clear she has no grand ambition to be, you know, an appropriations subcommittee chairwoman on Ways and Means, or a, you know, or something like that, right? Ways and Means, Appropriation, Energy, and Congress. She's not there to actually govern. She's just there to squawk, right? And with congressmen like that, it's very difficult for the parties to offer them goodies, right? If Pelosi doesn't have like punishments to dole out, she also doesn't have goodies. And what's interesting is that this is an analogous problem to a lot of the Tea Party guys who came into power in 2011, and were some of them who tended to be loudmouths, were given status on Fox News to come on and bash leadership and say whatever they want. And when it came time to actually govern and we need your vote, they were nowhere to be found. And there's only so much you can do about these people. And in a lot of cases, you duty bound to protect them, right? To keep on, because Pelosi has sort of said, you know, nobody's going to be challenging these people, you know, because she can't, because they have independent power bases of their own. So it's almost sort of an inverted sort of situation now, where like the gadflies actually have leverage over the leadership, which is really bizarre.
Right. And we kind of talked about that last week when, John Boehner, when he was speaker, is kind of old school. I guess there was a vote where, you know, they were, you know, reelecting him as speaker, and some people had broken off and voted for Justin Amash or something like that. And he penalized some of them by removing them from committees, which just created this, you know, people were howling about it, you know, but that kind of fits in. Is that kind of an example of what you were talking about, where the old school guy was like, you know, you didn't get in line, so now, you know, you're going to suffer the consequences.
Right. And we have this instinct as Americans to say, oh, well, Amash and the gadfly, you know, they should be able to do what they want, and, you know, but, you know, the problem, the value, I'll say, of strong party organization to bring people like Amash and Ocasio-Cortez into line is that by creating party unity within Congress, you translate vote choices for Republicans and vote choices for Democrats into, we're going to pursue this agenda, right? So, like, you vote for the Democrats, you know what you're getting. Right. Like, for instance, right, the Democrats did not, when the Democrats won handily in 2018, did voters in swing districts swing districts in like where I live in Pennsylvania, right? Connor Lamb's victory in Pennsylvania in the northern Pittsburgh suburbs. Did the people in the northern Pittsburgh suburbs vote for Connor Lamb over Keith Rothfuss for the Green New Deal? Absolutely, positively no. This is not something they are interested in, right? They're not interested in the Green New Deal. But the Green New Deal has come to dominate the agenda because of this gadfly who's very good at manipulating social media. See, this is an example of how a lack of party organization empowers these gadflies to actually do things that the voters never voted for, right? That's sort of the problem with this, is that it seems like, oh, like having more people talk is a good thing. That's very American, right? We shouldn't be suppressing views through rigorous party organization. But it's through party organization that, at least in theory, you can say, okay, this is what the voters voted for. That's going to be our agenda. And anything else is not on our agenda. Ocasio-Cortez, you're a freshman, sit in the back and be quiet, right? Like, we're here to protect Obamacare and to moderately increase social welfare. We're not here to, like, spend $100 trillion putting solar panels on every, cat and dog in the country.
Right. And now it's funny you bring up Connor Lamb, because that was an example I raised of a situation where the party very much kind of like were the ones who got him the nomination. Is that correct? It wasn't like he won in an open primary.
Yeah, that's right. And Lamb is a good illustration of the value of strong, good party organization, right? Because Lamb was able to pick up a seat that, really, it was candidate choice that netted him the seat in the first place, right? Like all the way back last year in that special election. I don't even remember the name of the guy that he ran against, but he was a total dud. And Lamb's a good candidate, and that was the choice of that. That was the Democratic, local Allegheny Democratic Party being better than the Republican Party in the area. It wasn't the Republicans in Allegheny County that picked what's his name. But yeah, that's an illustration of the virtue of party organization. Now, and again, all of this, let me just stress, all of this is in theory, right? In practice, party organization can be a disaster, right? The devil is very much in the details. My contention primarily in the article is that a complete lack of strong party organization that disciplines candidates and actually exercises real power over our discourse has created just this, what I would describe as a cacophony, is what our politics is. And I think at the top of the program, you, Jay, said it was like exhausting, right? I think that this is a big reason why. It's because any moron can get themselves onto, Rachel Maddow or Tucker Carlson and try to set the agenda. And, often they're successful.
Right. Because we talked a little bit about guys like Jim Jordan and the Freedom Caucus guys, who were the ones that were causing all this kind of trouble, when Barack Obama was president. And, Republicans like Paul Ryan or John Boehner would work out some kind of legislative arrangement with Obama, or they'd get something out of the deal. And then, Meadows and Jordan and all of them would be, no, we're opposed to it. And they, essentially then it would come down to the wire. Republicans would have to give up all the little victories that they had secured and basically get nothing out of the deal. And, then you wind up with a complete loss and you don't even get these little tiny things.
Yeah, that's right. That actually points to another virtue of party organization, which is that it enables specialists to dominate political proceedings. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean, to your point, right? Boehner and McConnell and Ryan would work out these policy deals with Obama that, as you said, had little victories. And McConnell has been in the Senate since 1986. He knows what he can get. He knows what he can't get. Right. He knows what to fight for. He knows when to fight. He knows when to walk away. Right. He's an expert. OK. And he's the sort of guy that a smart party would empower. Right. He's the sort of person that you want as your delegate to handle these matters in difficult inter-party negotiations, right? Meanwhile, these Tea Party guys would come in and, as you said, scuttle the deal, which would shift the final product to the left. And then they would go on television and they would speak to the mass public, which does not have the specialty information necessary to actually perceive what happened, and denounce McConnell and Ryan and Boehner as being traitors to the cause. You see, and that's one of the problems there that we have with this, with mass media, is that they go over the experts and they appeal to the mass public. And, you know, just this is not, this is that sort of in the weeds kind of thing about, you know, inter-party negotiations and, you know, these omnibus resolutions. They're very easy to demagogue and very easy to sort of give the public the wrong impression. And the Tea Party Freedom Caucus would basically go out to onto Fox News and say McConnell's the traitor, even though they're the traitors. Right. And you see this effect in McConnell. If you look at McConnell's favorable ratings among Republicans, I would say, as somebody who's done a good bit of study of the Republican Party, I'm hard pressed to think of a more effective Republican Senate leader since Bob Taft, which is really saying something, because the Republicans in the post-war era have had some really good Senate leaders. I'm hard pressed to think of anybody who's been better than Bob Taft. Right. And yet McConnell consistently has had the lowest favorable ratings among Republicans, which is a sign that his own voters don't really understand what he's been able to accomplish for them. And I think a big reason why is that these gadflies get on television and they give people the wrong impression. And this is an example of how the, you know, our politics is being dominated by big mouths, whereas I think that a stronger party organization could shut these people up a little bit and would actually add discipline, and but discipline leading to focus and ultimately greater democratic accountability, because then you would know, I'm voting for Republicans, it's going to mean this thing. And I'm voting for Democrats, it's going to mean this thing, as opposed to, you know, I vote for Republicans and they create a shutdown crisis, or I vote for Democrats and, you know, I get the Green New Deal. People don't want either of those things.
Right, and I think it was your soon to be former president Arthur Brooks. I don't know if he's officially resigned yet, or it's like June or something like that.
I think it's coming.
Yeah, yeah. He said in an interview with Politico, he said we're being governed, or we're being like governed by the fringes. So, you know, there's this 15% on the right, 15% on the left, and then there's the 70% that are more in the middle, who actually don't have a bigger voice. And he kind of pointed out, I think he talked about social media and cable television and everything, where it's like having the measured kind of, you know, and in a way you might say the word boring guy.
Yeah.
You know, a guy like Paul Ryan, who was mostly a policy guy, who could sit there and talk about Medicare reform and tax policy, but he wasn't the kind of bombastic, you know, guy that would go out there and just make a whole bunch of noise. And so people considered him like this lousy speaker. And one of the things I pointed out was, like, the first budget reconciliation thing that he worked with Obama, it was one of the things that he secured was the lifting of the ban on the export of crude oil in the United States. And it was one of those things where the Tea Party people all screamed that he gave Obama everything that he wanted and got nothing in return. And, you know, we listed off a bunch of things that he did get in return, because it was finally one of these points where they just said, okay, it's his first one, we're not going to cause too many waves and we'll let it go through, but they still complained about it. And so, you know, one of the things that you mentioned here, and I just want to kind of ask you to get into this a little bit because it's interesting, is McCain-Feingold,
yes,
which you said has done a lot.
McCain-Feingold has been a disaster for American politics.
And explain that a little bit.
Utter disaster. That legislation is just... It's one of those things that has been calamitous for American politics. And George Bush, it was the number one biggest mistake that he made on a domestic policy front, signing that garbage piece of legislation into law. I'll say that. Not only that, the challenge with McCain, this is the thing, and Congress has done this multiple times. Right. What ends up happening is Congress passes this piece of legislation that is unconstitutional in some way, and which McCain-Feingold was, and FICA before it was as well. McCain-Feingold replaced the 74 or revised or updated the 74 amendments to the Federal Elections Campaign Act, both of which were declared unconstitutional in parts. And so we get this legislation that has been, like, you know, basically they've had this kind of excision by the Supreme Court, and the end product is completely beyond what anybody would possibly want. When this has now happened two times in the last 50 years. It happened in 1977 with Buckley versus Vallejo. Maybe that was 78. I think it was 77. And then it happened with Citizens United. Two times this has happened. Right. And now, so what's my, I have a lot of specific beefs with McCain-Feingold, but McCain-Feingold paved the way for this situation in which we have right now, where these super PACs, which are unresponsible to anybody, right, are able to basically dominate politics. And we also, frankly, get these, you know, it's not just that they're not, it's, you know, candidates set up their own super PACs that are technically like, you know, independent, but nod, nod, wink, wink, you know, and just. One of those things is sort of like a good small R Republican laws that have easy workarounds to undermine respect for the law. And like nobody respects campaign finance law because there's so many easy workarounds. But the real, in my opinion, the greatest flaw of McCain-Feingold was eliminating what was called soft money. Soft money was a form of party of campaign spending that was heretofore unregulated by campaign finance law, right? And so how did that happen? Well, the state parties were able to collect unlimited amounts of money from donors, from anybody, for the purposes of what was called party building activities. So you could do ads touting the virtues of your party. You could spend money on buildings and flyers touting the party, just anything related to, you know, party advocacy that stopped just short of candidate advocacy. And the virtue of soft money is that it was to be spent by the parties themselves. So prior to prior to McCain-Feingold, it was not super PACs that were the big, big actors in, you know, campaigns. It was really the parties. And one of the things that would happen is the Republican National Committee or the House and Senate arms, right, the NRCC and the NRSC, would collect soft money and they would distribute it to the states and localities, right? And so this would be a way for politics on the campaign level to be organized in large measure around the parties. McCain-Feingold eliminated that because they thought that it was corruption, right? But like I said, these things have to be sort of taken in with account of whatever the Supreme Court decides is unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court decided that it was outlawing soft money was constitutional. You could do that, but that you could not stop somebody from spending unlimited amounts of their own money on any message they wanted, so long as it was independent. It was bizarre. Like in Supreme Court jurisprudence on campaign finances itself, a disaster, right? So what we get in the post McCain-Feingold, post Citizens United situation is the parties are tightly constrained about what they can spend. But gadflies like the Koch brothers, and I'm a fan of the Koch brothers, but they're gadflies, or Tom Steyer can spend as much as they want. They can't spend it through the parties. They can't write a big old check to the Republican Party. That can be outlawed by Congress. Or wrap your mind around that, because I don't understand it. Yeah, they can't write a check to the Republican National Committee to spend the money, but they can spend the money themselves. That's the situation that McCain-Feingold created.
Or they can write a check to a super PAC that's affiliated with a candidate for as much as they want. Like
but
you said,
not
wink,
really,
wink.
Nod, nod, wink, wink.
Right.
The whole thing is a disaster. And look, I mean, McCain-Feingold fits in a broader trajectory of campaign finance. Like we have been screwing up campaign finance since all the way back in 1907. Right. Like if you go all the way back to the 1800s, the parties financed politics through patronage. That's how they financed politics. I'm actually a big fan of the patronage system. It was corrupt, but it was also like the parties were like independent, right? Because they got the spoils from office and they decided how the money went. Well, in 1883, the federal government outlawed patronage and the state governments followed suit. So but you still needed money. Right. You still had politics is expensive, which is a fact that Americans still to this day refuse to wrap their minds around. Politics costs like a lot of money. Somebody has to pay for this. Patronage was a way to pay for it. But after they outlawed patronage, the parties had to go find how we're going to finance things. They went to big business is what they did. First, they went to the railroads and then they went to the monopolists like Rockefeller and Morgan and those people. And this is where you get the Tillman Act of 1907, which outlawed corporate contributions to candidates and parties. It follows with Taft-Hartley in 1947, which applies the same thing to labor unions. And then in 1971, They reinforce that, but they allow for political action committees, which ends up opening the floodgates of corporate money back into politics. And McCain-Feingold keeps that in place. But this is the thing. Even as they're allowing interest groups to participate through these, you know, political action committees, they don't bring the, they continue to constrict the parties. Right. So the way I like to think about it, almost like imagine like the parties being like the heart of American politics, but the arteries are just getting more and more narrow because the parties can't raise the money. And like they can raise the money now, but only as super PACs. Like they're like the NRSC is only really an effective agency insofar as it operates a super PAC, which has to be independent of all the Republican candidates, which is just stupid. I mean, the whole thing is just stupid. And it's and like the left doesn't have any solutions to any of this because they just want to outlaw super PACs. So where's the money going to come from?
And you know? So
I mean, it's a disaster.
So let me add, and just to add, like you said about George W. Bush signing McCain-Feingold, what was worse is that when he went to sign it, he goes, "I think this is unconstitutional, but I'm going to sign it anyway," right. Thinking the court would strike the entire thing down.
A basic derelict. I mean, I'm a fan of Bush on balance, but yeah, that's a dereliction of duty, right? You take an oath of office to preserve, protect, and uphold the Constitution, right? One of the reasons why the president was given a veto in the first place by the founding fathers was to stop intemperate, unjust, or unconstitutional laws, right? And when you have a president signing a law that, you know, let's be honest, Bush hated that law. He thought it was intemperate, unjust, and unconstitutional, and he signed it anyway.
Right. Yeah, that's just crazy. So let me ask you. So based upon that, because one of the things you think about it, and we mentioned several different people. We talked about, Justin Amash and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And, you know, you look at 2016 and you look at how Bernie Sanders did. And, of course, Donald Trump.
Yep.
These are four people who are not generally considered members of, or who would say that about themselves that they're not necessarily members of the party. So like Justin Amash says, I'm a libertarian, but he's, you know, he runs as a Republican, and AOC runs as a Democrat. I mean, those are socialists. Same thing with Bernie Sanders and even Donald Trump, who, you know, so basically they use the parties as vehicles to be able to get themselves elected. Now, let's just assume for a second that McCain-Feingold didn't exist. Would the parties have more power on the state level to kind of push who they wanted to get as a nominee, or do you think that that is kind of blown up anyway?
I think that they would have more power, but the other issue here, so there's two main sources of power that they've lost. The first one is through campaign finance. The second one is through primaries, right, and direct primaries of candidates. Now, that's a very old thing, right? The first direct primary law was in Minnesota in 1899, I want to say. They're very old, but this, again, all this stuff has an interactive effect with the media landscape. So now we're in a situation, and again, this is something that's pretty old. I mean, you look back at Kennedy sort of ran the same basic playbook, right? Where it's sort of a campaign of personality outside of the typical party pathways, right? Like, for instance, Kennedy won the nomination in 1960. Eleanor Roosevelt left in a huff. She hated Kennedy, right? Kennedy was sort of a gadfly too, right? He was kind of a right crazy right winger in a lot of respects, right? So that's sort of these things have been happening for a while, but I don't know if the pace has quickened or because of social media and the new like media environment in general, or we're just noticing it a while now. But I would analogize it to a tragedy of the commons, right? Like we mentioned Amash and Trump and Bernie, none of whom are really like actual partisans, right? Like Amash is a libertarian. Trump was a Democrat until very recently. Bernie is only a Democrat for the purposes of running for the nomination, right? Otherwise, he'll say, I'm a socialist.
Right. And he's not even an official member of the Democratic Party. He's not. He's independent.
Yeah. So I would liken this to the party being like a common area, right? And the sort of like, how do you keep the commons nice? Like at a university or something, you know, you have to have rules about like, hey, you know what? We just planted new seeds. Don't walk on the grass or you're going to ruin it for everybody, right? But the thing is that, you know, unless you have guardrails up or you actually have somebody watching out to make sure people don't trample on the new seeds, people are going to ruin it because that's what they do. Because it's in, you know, I don't care, I'm late. You know, I'm going to run across the grass because I need to get where I'm going. And it's just one person. What's the harm? Problem is that everybody has the same incentive. So the grass gets ruined, right? Unless you put up, you know, fences or have somebody out there actually saying, hey, get out the grass, chucklehead, right? Like the parties are a very similar thing, right? The value that parties provide to society is clear signals about what it stands for as an entity. And therefore, again, like I know what the Republicans generally stand for. I know what the Democrats generally stand for. So I'm going to vote Republican. And that's going to, you know, like that's how we translate vote choices into policy preferences, because we all know what these parties stand for, right? But to make sure that the parties stand for something, they have to stop these free riders, right? People from they have to stop people who are just, you know, using it to trample on the grass, right? And, you know, with all due respect to Justin Amash, who I think is, you know, an honest guy, I disagree with him, but he's not a Republican, he's a libertarian. And Donald, like, and a great example of this problem is the incoherence of the Republican Party on the issue of tariffs, right? Like, you know, because you couldn't, the Republican Party since World War II has been a free trade party until Donald Trump comes on the scene. And now we're nothing. Like, we're a little free trade, but we're a little protectionist, right? That's an example of, you know, a party ideology or party message that has been, you know, basically skunked because of the open primary system. Whereas, you know, in theory, I'd like to see a situation in which, like, you know, look, you want to run for the Republican nomination? You have to be a Republican. Period. End of sentence. You have to basically, you have to agree with the principles of the Republican Party, one of which since, you know, the 1940s has been, you know, free trade. You know, and now that's not to say that, you know, I have a problem with people who are skeptics of free trade. I mean, to each their own in terms of their opinions. But look, the Republican Party is a free trade party. And if you want to change that, then you get the platform changed and you convince the rest of the party. This is a free trade party. If you want to run in this party, you got to be a free trade candidate. But the Republicans don't have something like that because they don't have the ability to say, no, you're not going to be our nominee because we disagree with you. Well, we've seen that. We saw that. With Trump, he disagreed with the Republicans on a whole bunch of things, but but he won the delegates, and they were like, okay, well, the people have spoken, and we're just going to change. And that, see, you'd think, okay, well, that's good because that's openness. But again, you think about the broader value of a stable party identity. That it, you know what the Republicans stand for. If people know what the Republicans stand for, it means by extension that when the people vote for Republicans, they want Republican-style things. But on the other hand, if you have a situation where it's like, where does the Republican Party stand on trade? I don't know. It depends on who in the party you ask. That means then by extension that a vote for the Republican Party doesn't actually really mean anything about where you stand on trade. This is the problem with parties that can't police their own. It means the party message gets muddled, and therefore your voter sovereignty or voter influence over public policy declines because a vote for the Republicans doesn't mean as much as it otherwise could have.
Right. And so what do you say then? So let's sit there and turn this around. So, pretend I'm a critic here and I'm saying, well, you know, I'm glad that they're doing this because, you know, the parties have been so corrupt and they haven't been listening to the voters and they haven't been doing. Now, Jay, I know you, as much as anyone, has been very critical of the GOP and what some of the things they haven't done, especially as regards to, you know, everybody likes lower taxes, but you've been critical of what you call deficit spending taxes, tax cuts or tax reductions, and you've talked about these things. But at the same time, so what is somebody, what do you say to someone who comes along and says, well, Donald Trump is good because he's blowing things up?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, you don't. Yeah, I just don't, frankly, have a lot of respect for that impulse. I just don't. I think that the idea of like blowing things up is, you know, I that's just awfully nihilistic, if you ask me. You know, like the assumption is that anything would be better than what we have right now. Well, for starters, things in this country are pretty good. I mean, let's be honest, right? Standards of living are up, like, you know. We're all expected to live to the age of 80. We're not in any major wars right now. You know, taxes are reasonably low. The government isn't like, you know, I mean, we all dislike, at least on the right, we dislike the government, but they're not like, you know, harassing us by and large. Things are pretty good. especially when you look at it through the grand sweep of American history, right? Is this really, is that a prudent, I would say to somebody who says, I want to blow, I probably wouldn't say this to them in person because I don't like to, I'm not very confrontational on an individual basis, but I would say that that's an immature, imprudent attitude. And I would say, shame on you for being so short-sighted and narrow-minded and just have, frankly, having a temper tantrum. Right. Like, does that mean I don't think things should be reformed? Yes, things should be reformed. But there is a difference between reform and blowing things up. There's a huge difference. Right. Reforming things suggests like we're going to go back. We're going to find the essence of what made this country great, what made it good, how those ideals translate into policy and procedural reforms. And we're going to re-envision things, right? We're going to update our ideals for the 21st century. That's reform, right? This sort of like blowing things up is just, we're just going to smash things down with a hammer because we're mad. That was my objection to Donald Trump, to be perfectly honest, you know? And it still is my objection to Donald Trump, I would say. That like, that's just not a very... That is an irresponsible attitude, I would say. That would be somebody who has hit the first step of sort of like, okay, I'm unhappy with the way things are, right? But the second step is figure out why you're unhappy. And the third step is get yourself behind a program to fix it. You know, this is one of the things that really kind of, I think there's an inherent contradictory element to this sort of populist movement. Like if you compare the populists of today to say the populists of the 1890s, the populists of the 1890s were like, okay, our platform is we're going to have free silver and we're going to take over the railroads. Like they had diagnosed the problem and recommended a solution, right? Populists today, like listening to them, it's sort of like, I'm angry. That's all they say. Okay, good. Good for you. You're angry. We're all angry. Everybody can get, especially if you're on social media too much. What do you want to do about it? I want to blow things up. Well, okay. Then what? Well, I don't know. Well, that's not a policy agenda, you know? And, you know, as a father of two young children, I'm not really down for blowing stuff up. I need to know what's going to happen next. You know, that's my attitude. And so, like, I've been frustrated with the course of public policy in this country, and I've been working through these things, and maybe my ideas are good, but, you know, come on, they're probably bad, but at least I've been thinking about it. You know, that's more than just saying I want to blow things up.
Well, I mean, a perfect example of that was Trump when he decided to veto spending bill. The government shut down, and it was like, you know, it was one of those things kind of like what Ted Cruz did in 2013. It's like, well, okay, well, what is your plan? Like, how do you plan to use this to get what you want? And neither of them could come up with an idea. They just thought the other side is eventually going to fold. And it's like they have no reason to fold.
I think also, this idea of disruption for its own sake is really stupid in a country that is, you know, what's our GDP, like $9 trillion or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Right? You start disrupting things for its own sake, you know. Look at what happened when Trump shut down the government. Look what happened to the Dow Jones, right? And this is not like the roaring 20s when only a handful of people had money in the stock market, right? Those are people's 401k accounts, you know. And more broadly, you know, one of the advantages the United States, and one of the reasons we're able to run the structural deficit that we need to run to protect Medicare, and if you watch Fox News regularly and you watch the ads, you notice that all the people who want to blow things up, you know, on watching all these people on, you know, the Fox News talking about blowing things up. And then they go to a commercial and it's all ads for Medicare. Right. You know, that's not a coincidence. Right. You know, but, you know, we are running a massive deficit, structural deficit, particularly because of Medicare Part B, which is an open checkbook. Right. And like we are able to do that because the rest of the world continues to buy our debt. Now, do you think they will buy our debt if in a temper tantrum we smash all the institutions of government and policy? And if they stop buying our debt, how are we going to pay for your hip replacement? That just seems really short-sighted to me, and a perfect example of, you know, frankly, our citizenry, and I say this about on the left and the right, our citizenry is not doing the basic legwork that's necessary to maintain self-government. They're just not. They don't understand what's going on, and people are angry, and they say, I want to smash things up. And the reason that that's what they say is because they're not doing the basic arithmetic of citizen required of citizens to figure out what to do about it, to diagnose the problem and to adopt or at least endorse solutions.
Right. Well, that would.
I think it's just laziness, to be perfectly honest. I think this country is full to bursting with bad citizens.
Thank you.
I
advocate this all the time. Like Jay said earlier today, he said something about that only people will know Kirstjen Nielsen. It was the idea that Kirstjen Nielsen will only be remembered as the person who separated families. And Jay was saying, oh well, she'll only be known for that for a very short amount of time. Only a few people know about that. I'm like, actually, not even a few people know about that, or most people. Almost no one knows that that's who that is, or who was doing that, or that she got fired. But yeah, and so Jay, just really quick, so I can add you to my if I start my petition to repeal the 17th Amendment, will you sign on to that?
Look, I'll say this: like one of the problems I think we have is that we have too much liberalism in this country, and I mean that in the modern sense, in the classical sense, the sort of idea of individual rights, things that we're entitled to. Right. Me. Right. Which is not how the framers envisioned self-government actually functioning. Right. Like they envisioned a liberal republic wherein we are entitled to certain rights. But ultimately, the people have to be the guardians of that right and ultimately have to be the guardians or the advocates of the public interest, that we are the final check against government gone awry. Right. Which requires not just what are you going to give me? But, like to borrow Kennedy's phrase, right? Ask not what the government or country can do for me, but what I can do for the country, whatever the phrase was. Obviously that's become a Ted Sorensen cliche, but I think that's an ethos that's really frankly been lost. And people aren't doing the basic legwork of figuring out how does Medicare work? How does Social Security work? Mm-hmm. Why do we have soldiers still in Korea? Why do we still have soldiers in NATO? Like, not just complain about this, but like, why? There's a reason we do, right? Like, we demilitarized, Japan, and we demilitarized Korea. We did it for a reason. And before you start suggesting, President Trump, that we should revisit that, maybe figure out why we did it in the first place. And that's just the basic arithmetic of citizenship.
Yeah,
which I don't really see people do.
Right. And I don't think that it's really a one party or the other, because as we've seen with people saying, the Electoral College needs to be just, abolished. Well, if Donald Trump loses in 2020 and there's some kind of another mishap with popular vote versus Electoral College vote, you will have the same people on the right saying the exact same thing. And it's again, absolutely, going back to this destroying of norms. And yeah, I mean, we're it's basic citizenship that I get so frustrated as someone who majored in political science when people say to me on Twitter, well, why should we keep the Electoral College? And I sit there and say, you would have to go start from the bottom up of the mindset that is behind our structure of government to not have that. And so
it's
basic.
And there's a lack of reverence for our governing institutions and frankly, a lack of appreciation look, this is the longest running written constitution still in effect in the world. Maybe Massachusetts has been in effect longer, right? But other than that, in the world, it still works pretty gosh darn good. The Constitution, I mean, obviously there were a lot of factors that took us from, an agrarian backwater in the West to being the dominant power in the history of the world. But it's certainly in the top five reasons our structure of government's got to be in there. Let's not tinker around with this thing because Hillary Clinton couldn't see fit to go to Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, it's insane. So, all right. So on that note, we're gonna wrap up. We talked about this. For those who listened earlier, talking about the premium content, we're gonna for the regular podcast, we're gonna end. But then Jay's gonna stick around, and we're gonna talk about some other stuff related to the 2020 election. But you know, for those who are kind of finished up at this point, Jay, where can everybody find you?
Well, you can always find me at JCostTWS on Twitter. And I host a podcast with National Review called Constitutionally Speaking. So if you find my angry rantings about the Founding Fathers interesting, I have a copious amounts, hours upon hours of that stuff available for you. At National Review Online, I write a column on Mondays, and I have a book that's out. It came out last summer. It's called The Price of Greatness, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and the Creation of American Oligarchy. You can find that at Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Yeah. See, now if Jay can do all that stuff, then, you know, like he was telling those voters out there who are kind of lazy, it's like, you know, do something, you know, so
do something.
Everybody has stuff to do. Andrea, where can everybody find you?
On Twitter at Andrea and Ruth. And you can also sign up for the ARC Digital newsletter, which I curate at least once a week, if not twice.
Right. And I'm Jay Caruso. You can find me at Twitter at Jay Caruso. And, you know, I also write a weekly newsletter called The Monday Notice. You can sign up for that. Go to my Twitter profile. And there's a link in there for that. So that's going to do
Jay, it. Jay, real quick. Anybody, I always forget this. I also do a podcast called The Right Side with Kimberly Ross. And this week, if you want to tune in for just one episode, we're going to be talking about why she was gone the last 2 weeks, which will be a very personal episode. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
You want to catch that. See, Andrea's not very good at promoting herself.
So no.
All right. So that's going to do it for this issue, for this episode of The Fifth Estate. And we will see you next time.